VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
The Rugby World Cup from The Times with Mark Suster.
We'll be with you every week with the latest from the tournament, looking at the prospects for the home nations and the other big guns, of course, and reviewing all the action on and off the field.
Find it at thetimes.co.uk or in iTunes.
Welcome to The Game, the football podcast that never complains about playing twice in a week. Today I'm joined by Matt Hughes, Julien Laurens, and Mr. Paddy Barkley. Later on we'll be debating the rights and wrongs of third-party ownership, but first, let's get our teeth into the weekend's action, and let's start with the team that's top of the table. Manchester City, joint, of course, with United. Paddy, I want to start with you. Yeah. David Moyes, we know, makes things tough. City had a lot of the ball, but just couldn't really do anything, despite the Nasri, the Silva, the Dzeko, and the Aguero.
Mm. It was a victory of potential champions, no doubt about it, because these are the kind of tough games, such as Manchester United had at Stoke, where you do drop points. They just kept going. And the thing about Manchester City is there is so much class there, and the same applies to United. Same used to apply to Arsenal. There's so much class that if things are not going too well, a substitution is likely to do the trick. And thus it proved. So it was at the moment. I think that if you're champions of Manchester, you're champions of England.
Hughesy, when you are playing against a packed, very well organized defense, and you've got sort of the four skillful guys up front, how do you penetrate? Because I kind of got the impression that with Nasri and Silva doing some of the same things, that it was always going to be basically either like a moment of brilliance or a defensive error, for City to score. Could this actually be a situation where this formation at home might actually be less effective?
We wondered at the start of the season if Nasri and Silva could play in the same team, and I think quite a few people have been surprised at how effective they have been, because they're kind of similar players, great on the ball, great touch, great movement, and they're great when things are going for you. When things are going against you and you've got to work a bit harder off the ball, and maybe you do need something different. But I think Paddy's right. Man City will win many games without playing great, just because the foul part, the firepower they've got, and they can change it. And if you see Nasri go off, Silva go off as a defender, you may relax after they can come on and score the winner. So they've got a pretty formidable combination of players.
Of course, Julien, it took an Italian guy to come on and fix it, Super Mario. It's his second goal in two games, although one of them is in some obscure thing called the League Cup, which I don't really know what that is. But is this something that, can Mario be the added value off the bench? Can he move ahead of Tevez? We'll get to Tevez in a minute, but does he bring something different from Dzeko?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think he's perfect coming off the bench, much better than I think when he's starting.
Don't tell him that.
I won't. But you see, the thing with him is he's so talented, but still so young in his head as well, and in his approach of the game, that I think he will bring much more to the team coming off the bench like he did on Saturday, instead of starting and playing, the first 70 minutes or something, where I think because he can't stay focused for the whole game, and he will, you know, he will drop his level. And just to follow Paddy and Yuzi, I'm a bit skeptical actually about City. I think the game they played at Tottenham was outstanding because they played two-touch football. Yeah, on Saturday against Everton, every single player with the ball had 5, 6, 7 touches. And the problem is that Silva does it, Najri does it, Aguero does it, Yaya Toure does it. And I think at some point they'll struggle, because in that team, sometimes they all want to be the one that's going to make things happen instead of playing together. And it's too much for me. At times, it's too individualist football than collective football.
Are you saying they should look at Barcelona? Barcelona are the most unselfish football team exactly. You've ever seen in your life.
And in Tottenham, they were very unselfish, all of them. And if you see it...
Yeah, they played like Barcelona.
Exactly. And a lot of goals came from the wings. Najri sent two crosses for Dzeko. Against Everton, hardly anything came from the wings. Nothing at all. Because they all came in the middle. And Yaya Toure and Aguero and Najri and Silva were all there. And it just didn't work. And if you see, they didn't create any chances. And the goal came from a deflected shot by Balotelli as well.
You don't have to criticise Balotelli.
No, but
one guy.
No, but I think they'll have to be careful, because you know, if they don't get it right as a team and playing just simple football, they could struggle on games like Everton.
All right, let's talk some Everton now. People here know about my bromance with Davy Moyes. That said, you know, when it comes to sort of negativity and defensiveness, if certain managers who were less popular and less intelligent than David Moyes put out a team with Tim Cahill as their lone striker, at a time when, you know, I might add, I'm reading now from the newspaper, you've got Billy Letnikov and Denis Strakwalursi, hereafter to be referred to as Strack, on the bench, and you've got Velios and Saha, who are strikers, and Drente, who's sort of an attacking type, at least in theory. Mm-hmm. This is kind of negative. I mean, I would have thought. I mean, should we be blaming, or is Moyes, is this just realpolitik from Moyes? And now I'll just go out there and, you know, play for the point.
It goes beyond me.
You're shaking your head.
I really don't understand what David. I don't mind him as a manager.
If Avram Grant did this, or Claudio Ranieri
exactly.
did this, right? Would they not be crucified right now?
Probably, yeah. And because it's Moyes, and because he's done a good job before for Everton, you know, I'm not saying that
he's still doing a good job.
He's still doing a good job with the, you know, he's got no money. It's a club with no, you know, even not a penny. They can only take people on loan, but still, it goes beyond me. I don't understand how you can approach a football game with like almost 11 defenders on, you know, or not far, at least defensive midfielders, and put Tim Cahill as a striker stroke offensive player in that team. It just goes, I don't understand how you can play such negative football and have such a negative approach.
Speaking of negative approaches, what's up with your negative friend Louis Saha? Is that all water
well,
under the bridge?
Well, it's for the very many English readers of Le Parisien. Yesterday, they saw a lovely interview in my paper done by myself of Louis Saha.
Which is why I'm asking.
Yeah. No, he was disappointed. The thing that disappointed the most is that he saw in the English press that they were saying that he refused to play for the reserve. That's why he was dropped. He was not refused to play for the reserve. He didn't refuse to play for the reserve. He was asked by Moyes if he was fit enough to play for the reserve. The thing is, he came back to training with the reserve on a Friday. They asked him to play for the reserve on the Monday with just one training behind him, and he said, listen guys, I've just trained once since coming back from injury. I don't feel I'm fit enough. I think it would be a risk for me to play with the reserve, so I would rather not play that game but maybe play later on. And apparently Moyes took it badly and then dropped him, but he didn't refuse. He was asked and said, honestly, I don't think I'm ready to play. What you could have been for France, for Brazil, for whoever, he would have said the same, I guess. It was not a point to play for the reserves or not. But that was it. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't want to have a fight with Moyes. That's not what he's saying. He's just saying that he's going to work hard. He's 33, so he wants to enjoy his football because he knows it's not going to last long. And you know, and he's out of contract at the end of the season. So he doesn't want a problem with Moyes. He would just be surprised not to be at least on the bench. That's all.
Seeing Moyes and Cahill, a lot of attention paid to the incident between Tim Cahill and Vincent Kompany. I'm going to try to describe it as best I can. If I say something incorrect or libelous, please feel free to jump in. But basically, Tim Cahill is running around terrier-like on the pitch, scything everything down the way he often does. He goes for a ball with Kompany. To me, it looks like he's just going straight into the back of him to foul him. Kompany, who knows he's coming, decides to be somewhat sneaky. And basically, you know, lifts his leg and stamps on his ankle. Husey, is that pretty much what happened?
That's the way I saw it. Yeah, I mean, it looked like a fairly premeditated act from Kompany, and you know, deserved to be punished.
Okay, does Cahill deserve to be punished as well for running around like that, or do we just take it as read that you know he's got commitment?
It's a fine line, isn't it? We saw it in the. In the Chelsea game, Torres was he didn't make any contact, but the intent was there. And I think it's one of those laws that not many people actually understand if you can be penalised for intent or not. So it's all down to the interpretation of the referee on the day, really.
Let me tell you what I think. I think it's, the law of the street is don't start something that you're not willing to finish. And in my opinion, Tim Cahill brought that on himself. It was a terrible tackle. I wouldn't be able to say 100% that Kompany meant to do what he did. I might be willing to say 90% that he did. But if you can't say 100%, how can you... I honestly do believe that Tim Cahill's tackle under the law as it was revised about 10 years ago about, you know, the so-called tackle from behind, which in actual fact is usually the tackle from the side, the tackle through the limb. That was a classic case of it and could have been a red card. Kompany, I don't know. But the point is, if Tim Cahill hadn't done it, he wouldn't have got it. And I don't have any sympathy for him whatsoever.
Mm. Julian, you're nodding along. I'm assuming that you were kicked quite a bit in your playing days.
Yeah, but this is so English, being entitled to.
Exactly.
In France, we never said that a player was entitled to almost break the leg of someone else to get to the ball. It's just since I arrived here, I've heard people saying, oh, he was entitled to go and try to get the ball.
The laws of the game.
Cahill could have never got
the game here. Okay. Are written by commentators, aren't they? Used to play football and played by a different convention.
It's getting kind of fruity in the studio here between Paddy and the cheese-eating surrender monkey over there. Husey, you're a hard Yorkshireman. Can you please tell them both that they're wrong?
They can't both be wrong, and I think probably on this instance I tend to side with Julian. It's always
thank you.
Sort of slyly amused, struck annoyed. I don't really get really annoyed, but it amuses me that in England we make more of a fuss about diving and simulation than we do about leg breaking tackles. It
quite
seems
right.
to be a sort of strange.
I don't know what Marcotti's playing at here. He's trying to imply that we don't all completely agree. Husey, I couldn't agree more with what you've just said. I couldn't agree with what Julian said. So how come Marcotti's trying to make it sound like a punch-up? It's more like a love-in.
All right, let's move on from Summer of Love here. Let's move on to Chelsea and Swansea. And but that to say, I have to start with another incident and another, you know, this time a red card. Fernando Torres, I'm assuming we don't need to debate this. Yes, even though there was minimum contact, that is always a straight red. Yes? Nobody wants to dispute that?
Yes. Yeah.
Good. Okay, now I would like somebody to give me some insight into what went through his mind. Now, Torres this is the first straight red of his career, at least as a professional. He's gotten red cards before, but that was in Spain before before coming to the Premier League. And it was always for two yellows, and it's almost always actually because, you know, he was getting the bejesus kicked out of him, and, you know, he either reacted or actually twice was actually for diving. Now, how does somebody who's having a good game, who's clearly turned the corner, who played very well the week before against United, everything's going swimmingly, you're in midfield, you're by the touchline, you know, you're up against somebody named Gower who's on the ball, who you know is about to lose it, and you go in, and you know, it's not dissing him, but, you know, realistically, Chelsea were dominating that game.
Yeah.
You go in and you do something like this.
You're quite right, Gabs. Everything you've just said will have gone through Torres's mind, and that's why he actually, if you look at it again, he kind of pulls out. There isn't actually a great deal of contact.
But why does he even start doing that?
Thank God the Swansea boy had to jump, but why does he start doing it? Because that's how you get points in English football. You run around and you do what Gale did. You do what Torres did.
All right, that's not really true or fair. No, I'm sorry. I'm going to stick up for English football here. It's not really true or fair. I mean, Ryan Giggs doesn't do that. He gets a lot of points in English football, right? He doesn't go and plant 2 foot tackles in somebody's head.
I'm saying it's one way of getting points.
Right, but it's not the way Torres needs to get points when he's actually playing well.
That's true.
And it's not something he's done before. I mean, Hughes, you obviously know your Chelsea. What gets me here in terms of the damage that could be done to Torres is Drogba comes on, scores a goal. I would assume that now, you know, obviously during those games when he's suspended, Drogba is going to play. What happens if Drogba goes on a scoring spree, Torres comes back, and or maybe Torres, you know, plays poorly in some of those Champions League games they have in between? Does Villas-Boas then have a huge problem?
I think Villas-Boas has got a lot of problems anyway, but some of them are quite nice ones. He's got a lot of good players to try and fit into a starting 11. With Torres, it's frustrating mainly for the player because he's just for the first time shown a few glimpses of what he can do. And my only expectation is that he was a bit high on success and the adrenaline got to him and he just wanted to show he was committed, wanted to show he was working hard as part of this team and that he was fitting in for the first time. And he just had a bit of a brain meltdown. I think there's any way of explaining it in any other terms, really. And it's a shame for him. But they've got Carling Cup games, they've got
I think
he'll get games in the meantime. I don't think he has to necessarily derail his season.
I think
Drogba would have to score 2 or 3 hat tricks to displace him, because Villas-Boas is clearly building a team around Torres, and it's for the first time showed it could potentially work.
It's been a dramatic resurgence, and I think that that Torres in the last two games has shown signs of being the player he was three years ago. And heavens, if he carries on like this, he might even be worth 2/3 of the fee that they paid for him, and that would be quite sensational. So the thing is, let's look at it. He misses 3 games, but let's look at it in the long term. It's going to be a long, long season. With a bit of luck, Chelsea will be in the Champions League when it gets serious next year. And the way he's been playing in the last two matches, he could have a serious part to play on for Chelsea then. Drogba is about 150 years of age, and although he's had a marvellous career, he's not going to be... I'm surprised that Chelsea didn't get rid last summer. I mean, he's best... I'm not knocking Drogba at all. But because he's, in my opinion, he's the best English type centre forward I think I've seen in the Premier League. I can't speak highly enough of him as a player, but you can't argue with your birth certificate.
Okay, best English type centre forward in the Premier League. Do I need to send Alan Shearer around to your
house?
Yes,
I would. I would put Drogba ahead of Shearer.
I wouldn't, but not Shearer at his best anyway. Julian, but does Villas-Boas pretty much need to build the team around Torres, given that A, the owner loves this man, and B, Chelsea have tied up over the life of his contract, you know, something well in excess of £100 million in this guy, and Torres is 27 and Drogba's 33. Is it as simple as that?
I think it is. What I would like to see, I would love to see Villas-Boas just changing a bit. For me, there's nothing new with him, and I'm a bit disappointed, to be fair, so far by him. Why doesn't he put Mata behind Torres?
I'm assuming that's the next step, isn't it?
Why waiting so long?
Means dropping Frank Lampard.
And Lampard is rubbish. He's like 155 years, he's 5 years older than Drogba. and if you see the goal of Torres on Saturday, Mata is in the centre. He knows exactly where Torres is, where he wants the ball. He gives it perfect ball.
What a lovely goal that was.
Exactly. And Mata and Torres would be deadly in the Premier League, playing one behind the other. And I don't know why Villas-Boas keeps playing that 4-3-3 that's like just not good enough, I think, for Chelsea.
Right,
I think that's what he's working towards. In the second half, Old Trafford, Matt was in the middle,
and it was so good.
I think we will see that, and it is a natural next step. The problem they have is they haven't really got natural sort of screening holding midfield players to play in the 2-4-2-3-1, and they're having to sort of make do with Ramirez and Mikel and maybe Lampard doing it.
Yeah.
And, Demi-Session.
Mikel's there's another one. How when are they going to get rid? I mean, have you ever seen a player who holds the game up like he does? I mean, he slows the game up more than Ballack did.
I know.
All right, okay. So you're saying Lampard's rubbish. You're dissing Ballack.
I think Essien's finished. But that's
okay,
story.
There we go. Another one. Yeah, it's easy to pick on the guy now. He's injured. I don't know. I guess I'm not. I mean, I agree with Matt. It's obvious that to me that, you know, he is thinking in terms of a 4-2-3-1. And he kind of needs to do that too, because he's got a billion strikers, and then that way he opens up another spot on his forward line. I thought actually Anelka and Mata both played very, very well coming inside behind the striker.
Yeah.
You know, Anelka's a clever guy. He's got some other issues, but you know he gets, I think, the football. But
why don't you think, Gab, that he hasn't done it yet? Or is it just in patches that he played that 4-2-3-1? Is it just because, like Matt said, there's no proper defensive holding midfielders? Well, he's a bit scared? What is he waiting for?
Mata only signed at the end of August. You know, you're not going to... If you play 4-2-3-1 without Mata, that means that you got to play Malouda in that position. And I also think he wanted to... You know, he wants to treat the Lampard situation respectfully. And Matt, I want to get you on this, because obviously he didn't play. There were reports that Lampard, when he found out that Josh McEachran was going to be the third substitute and not him, he got annoyed and went down the tunnel. I'm sure Chelsea put out a statement saying, no, he wasn't annoyed. He just had to go to the bathroom or something. But it's pretty clear, obviously, if you play 4-2-3-1, if you have Mata behind Torres and two wingers, you know, Frank either moves and becomes part of the two, or he sits on the bench. How are you reading this?
I think it's changing day by day and week by week. In the summer, on the pre-season tour, Lampard gave an interview in which he said, the day I can't get forward and score goals is the day I stop playing football. I think that day has now come, and he has to make a decision about whether he wants to still play and be a regular, semi-regular for Chelsea, or whether he's had enough. I think he will take the sensible, mature approach of thinking, right, I have to reinvent the way I play, I have to play deeper, I have to do the job that I've done for England for a few years under Capello. It's not new for Lampard. He played that way for Capello throughout the World Cup qualifiers, did pretty well.
And played that way for West Ham when he was an England under 21. I mean, I read that quote that Hughes talked about with bewilderment, because Frank Lampard is perfectly capable of playing as an all-round midfield player, as a
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
as a cautious midfield player, as Hughesy says, he did it for England very well when after Hargreaves lost fitness. It did a good job for the national team, and I mean, he's intelligent enough to play till he's 35. But you know, it might not be for Chelsea. It might not be in the Champions League, but it would be a shame to lose him.
Julien, you said he's rubbish. Can he do that, or is he just rubbish when he plays that position? Or can you see him partnering Ramirez or Mikel or Meirelles in that deeper position?
To play within that, you know, 4-2-3-1 in that two, he would need someone really, really strong next to him, someone like Makelele that Chelsea don't have at the moment.
Mikel's clearly stronger than Makelele physically.
No one plays that role like Makelele.
Younger, but do you know what I mean? He would need someone like that to play alongside him. Otherwise, I don't think he can play in that position. I have to disagree with Matt and Paddy. I don't know. He looked, you know, well finished for me. I can't see him, you know, anywhere near his best anywhere. I think he's 33. He's good. He's married or about to get married with a TV star. Well done. Make some babies. You know, enjoy your life. He's earned a lot of money already. And I can't see him playing for a top level club again. I don't think he's good enough.
I think you're being incredibly harsh, but I think back to something you know, Carlo Ancelotti said about the best footballing advice he's ever been given, which is when you come towards the end of the career, the one thing that you should do is be sure that you're the person who decides when you retire and not have somebody else decide for you.
There's also one thing I'd like to make clear, that you can combine a football career, even at Champions League level, with making babies. Because you get afternoons off, in fact, it's actually the perfect career for someone who wants to make babies.
I just think you should focus a bit more on making babies than playing in the Champions League.
Okay, this message brought to you by the government and their concern over the falling birth rates. Final point on Swansea. I was really looking forward to this. I hadn't seen them in person, and you'd heard about the wing play and stuff. They looked a lot worse in person than they look on TV. And I know, but I mean, I think it was just a bad day. It was just a bad day at the office. But I was intrigued by Nathan Dyer. He's sort of like a Sean Wright Phillips who can read the play and follow the ball and, you know, is actually, even though he's tiny, he's actually physically a little bit stronger. Anybody here impressed with the man?
Very, very much so. Dyer and Hoylett of Blackburn have been two players that have really caught my eye this season. Both very quick, very lively. Certainly in the case of Dyer, as you rightly identify, very bright with the use of the ball. The goalkeeper's having a rotten time at the moment, but that will come good. He's got a good record before coming to England. So I back him to finish not in the bottom three.
Our debate this week looks at third-party ownership. Now, you might have heard the story. There's a column in the paper by Matt Dickinson about this this new sort of, I actually call it a fund, a company, offshore based, set up by Peter Kenyon, the former Manchester United and Chelsea chief executive, which is basically a third party ownership scheme. You go in there, you plunk down your $250,000, and then the fund goes and buys players, or I guess they buy the economic rights to the players, although the term economic rights no longer exists according to FIFA. That's a whole other argument. But basically, they have the rights of the players. They don't own the players' registration. But to make a practical example, let's say I'm Aston Villa. I have a young midfielder named Barry Bannon. I think he might become very good in a couple of years, but I also kind of need the money now, but I'm not sure. So I go and I sell, say, 50% of the rights to Barry Bannon to third-party owner Paddy Barkley over here. So Paddy Barkley gives me £2 million, which I can spend right now. And then in a couple of years, I sell Barry Bannon to Manchester United for $10 million. I get another $5 million, and Paddy pockets $5 million, the other half. That's pretty much the way it works. Now, you may be familiar with this from, of course, the most famous case in England is the Tevez-Mascherano affair a few years back. As a result of that affair, third-party ownership is now illegal in England, and I believe in Scotland as well, although it's not illegal anywhere else in the world. What is illegal from FIFA's perspective is third-party influence, but I'm sure we'll get to that. A bit of an emotional issue, Paddy. Do you want to kick us off since you just bought half of Barry Bannon?
I'd love to. It doesn't really add up to very much. I mean, the whole of Barry Bannon, you could sort of balance on your palm of your hand. But a very good little player, a good example. Basically, my attitude towards this is that FIFA needs to approach it with saturation bombing, followed by a plague, followed by a flood. It is the worst, most pernicious idea, and my goodness, that's saying something, to come into football for many, many years. Far from being like so many things that are dressed up as an economy for clubs, in fact it will cost them a fortune and put them out of business, it also is deeply...
Right. How does it put a club out of business?
I'll explain later, but it is also deeply immoral. The whole point of football is that it should be run by clubs. It should be run by employers. You can't simply have hiring. You can't have large-scale third-party ownership, and this could well lead to it. If you have large-scale third-party ownership, you then have a serious danger of corruption. You referred earlier to the case of Tevez and Mascherano, which was a scandal, and all of the people, of course, involved in that were beyond reproach. But let's suppose you have a third party ownership scheme with players. We all remember the final game of that season when Tevez scored the goal that kept West Ham United in the league. Suppose the third-party ownership company, of which you've kindly made me a member, owned more players at Manchester United or more players at Sheffield United on that day than at West Ham United. Would Tevez have been encouraged not to score that goal? Of course he would. This must not get any further. It's a terrible idea. And FIFA must come down on it, as I say, with more than a ton of bricks.
Well, let me put this to you then. What if Manchester United, of course, Manchester United on that day had nothing left to play for. Mm-hmm. But what if United were locked in a battle for the Premier League title? And yes. Tevez, as often happens, of course, transfers get done early, yes, knew he was joining Manchester United next season.
Yes.
You don't have a problem with that?
Well, I mean, there's a limit to the number of safeguards you can make, of course. But let's not add... At a time when we're desperately worried about corruption, let's not add to it for no more reason. Let me put it this way as well. You talk about it, it'll be good for clubs. Right. How can it be? It's simply, you can't cut a cake 100 different ways and make it bigger. The cake remains the same size. And if this third-party ownership is to be profitable, it can only be profitable at the expense of the clubs. The clubs such as Crewe Alexandra, such as Manchester United, such as Barcelona, who thrive by youth development, can only lose from this. Because these companies will sweep up these people, as that already is happening in South America. For goodness sake, I can't believe that somebody's suggesting that we get this South American model of club ownership and bring it to Europe. It should be the other way round if we want to improve football.
We have to go and civilize those South Americans.
This is a quite hellish idea.
Anybody want to stick up for third-party ownership? Matt, I expect you to.
I'm not sure why, just because I occasionally have a phone call with Keir Drumshan doesn't mean I approve of the way he's made his money and the money for his many partners. I think you've got to look at who it benefits, and the overriding benefit is to the investors and these, the owners that we don't know who they are. I think in introducing additional levels, we're supposed to be making football more transparent and clear. We don't want... more and more
offshore.
No, no, but all right, Matt, I'm with you. I'm with you, Matt. Matt,
clubs.
Matt, I'm with you 100% on the transparency issue. And I think this is obviously one of the big issues, because one of the partners in this situation is Jorge Mendes, who, or certainly one of the consultants to the fund. And, you know, he happens to be an agent to a manager and to footballers at the same club, no less. I'm completely with you on that. But of course, I mean you have some level to corruption anywhere. You know, we can pass laws to make things more transparent, work to enforce them. But is the principle so wrong? Isn't the principle like, you know, if I have a company, you know, to raise capital, I will sell shares in that company. Isn't this the equivalent of selling non-voting shares in a company?
I don't think so, because you're talking about owning shares in an individual. I mean, would you like to be owned by, you're a very successful freelance journalist, would you like to be owned by, you know, various individuals all over the world who would take a slice of your income, or would you like some control over your own career?
Well,
the logical extension of this, and I don't like to use the word because it's completely inappropriate, but you get players who have no control over their career, and they're not slaves because they're being paid very well for it, but they don't have freedom in a sense that other footballers have freedom post Bosman.
Why do the footballers not have freedom though?
Because they don't have control of what they do. Tevez is stuck in a situation because of the ludicrous wages that he's earning and the ludicrous management fee that was his owners put in his contract when he signed for Manchester United.
But that's got nothing to do with third party ownership, though. He doesn't make a lot of money because, you know, he was previously owned by a third party. He makes a lot of money because he's very good and he plays for a club who threw a lot of money at him, right?
Yeah, but his notional market transfer value of £47 million is all to do with his ownership structure. That was the random figure put in a contract when he signed Manchester United, which is why Manchester United refused to sign him, which is why he can only sign for City, which is why he can't go anywhere else, because no one else is going to pay that laughable money. Any football club would not overvalue one of their assets.
I mean, this is just another way of siphoning more of football's money away from the game itself.
When you say from the game, you mean from the players, right?
No.
Because this is ultimately... Because this is the other thing which bugs me. Money going out of the game, it's money to the players.
If you want to know what I'm saying, we are moving into a different era. An era in which not all of the money in the game will be subject to prune juice economics, to quote Sir Alan Sugar. We are moving into an era in which football will become profitable, can become profitable for clubs. My dream is, instead of this rubbish, is that football can become subject to wider ownership in the way that's already happening to many, many smaller clubs, and that a wider ownership model can move into the top level of football, right, so that large numbers of ordinary people can, for the first time ever in the history of the game, make a little bit of money out of the clubs, whether they choose to plough it back or to take it and put it in the building.
Well, you know, Paddy, Tottenham Hotspur listed on the stock exchange, what, in 1987? Manchester United followed, you know, a lot of football clubs are listed. A lot of football clubs can, a lot of people, you know, you can do it through the stock market. They were able to do it back then. Uh-huh. And there are, you know, when we've had our friend Dave Boyle on, the former chief executive of Supporters Direct. Yeah. You know, there are, Supporters Direct, thankfully, is still around. And in fact, we just talked about Swansea.
Supporters Direct is an organization which I think is, it could be very beneficial to football.
But we're not talking about ownership models of football clubs. I want to bring the discussion back to third-party ownership.
No, but the whole point is that what we should be doing, and what FIFA should be doing, what the FA, and to its enormous credit, the FA, and in particular our current government, is actually doing, is guiding us towards these constructive ownership models.
This is a discussion for another day about...
And away from the kind of spivvery that is being suggested in terms of this scheme.
Hey, Julian, can you help me out here?
I just want to give an example, because we talked about Tevez and Mascherano, obviously. Gonzo, the Brazilian prodigy from Sao Paulo, yes. The playmaker, he's in that case as well.
So is Pastore.
Yeah.
Or was Pastore.
But Gonzo, PSG looked at signing Gonzo before Pastore. I think it was Leonardo's priority first. They looked at it and it was so complicated. It was just a nightmare for them if they had wanted to sign him. You know, and they had the money because now they can buy anyone. So it was not about that. It was about the structure of the deal because of that third ownership. And in the end, Gonzo didn't sign for PSG. And maybe, you know, he might struggle in his career to sign for a big European club because of the way things are structured around him. And that's why I think he's wrong for the players and for the game.
Okay, I'm going to put the case forward, though, for a lot of the reason why this exists. It's not like clubs in South America are just lawless. Or stupid, and they're so far behind us. What happens a lot in those countries is you have a very small club who will have a player, you know, one or more gifted players, and they're in a difficult situation because, you know, let's say, let's go back to Barry Bannon here. You know, let's say I'm Atletico Rafaela in Argentina, and I have a young midfielder named Barry Bannon, and he's 16 years old, and I'm quite excited about him. Boca Juniors come and says, "I want Barry Bannon. I'm going to go talk to his dad. I'm going to talk to his mom. I want him now, right? And I guess what? And I will pay you £1,000 for him." And you know he's worth more than that. And you know in a year or two, he could be worth a lot more than that. But the reality is, you've got a crumbling stadium. You've got to meet your wage bill. What do you do? And so, then third-party owner Pat Barkley, or Patricio Barkley in this case, comes along and says, you know what? Let me help you out. I will give you, you know, $500,000 right now, which is closer to what he might be worth. I will assume some of the risk that he turns out to be rubbish. And then, if you sell him in a couple of years' time, and you will sell him because you're a small selling club, then we're going to split the profits, right? So then, when the system works the way it should, and I'll be the first to say that it sometimes doesn't, Atletico Rafaela gets the $500,000, they can meet their wage bill, they can restructure their stadium, they hang on to the guy. 2 years from now, he turns out to be, if he turns out to be very good and they sell him for a lot of money, they split the cash. If he turns out to be rubbish, they don't. But hey, in the meantime, they spread the risk. They took, you know, that $500,000 for a share in the player. I mean, I don't understand why this is, you know, in principle, something so negative. We can all come up with examples where people cheat and steal and overcomplicate. Mm. But I mean, if it's
in this nightmare world that you outline, in future people like Sir Alex Ferguson, people who are very good at identifying talent, will no longer work for clubs, but will work for these massive companies. The whole thing, the game is spivvy enough without this, and I honestly don't know why you're giving it house room.
Well, yeah, because Matt Dickinson wrote about it, and the fund is starting up. And you know, if we all sit there and all repeat the same things, then it's not much of a debate.
I think it was a good debate.
Peter Kenyon and Kia Jurapshin and Matt Dickinson Mendes. All disagree with you. George Mendes does too, and they're all very handsome.
Oh, in that case,
George is
rich. In that case, it must be a good idea.
Right, well, here's a debate in a shorter form. How about some quick hits, or as Chris, the producer, likes to call it, off the fence. And by the way, I renew my invitation. Please come up with a better name, because otherwise this may lead to divorce between myself and Chris, the producer. Manchester United get a point at the Britannia, but Stoke make life very difficult without Rooney, with Chicharito getting hurt in the opening minutes. Sir Alex went with Berbatov and Owen, and neither was impressive. In fact, as somebody put it, Owen couldn't finish a sentence. Paddy, can United rely on those two this season, or should Sir Alex look elsewhere in his squad?
I must admit, I think that Sir Alex has got too many strikers this season. He talked pre-season about, oh, there's absolutely no problem in having seven or eight strikers, because don't forget we've also got Welbeck, Chicharito and blah blah blah, but I think he's got too many, and I think unless Berbatov plays regularly, he's not worth having.
Demba Ba scores a hat-trick as Newcastle pummel Blackburn 3-1 to hang on to fourth place and, say it softly, a Champions League spot. Matt, it's not going to last, is it? But since so many people are critical of Alan Pardew, will you say something nice about him? And also maybe something nice about Mike Ashley, or is that asking too much?
Well, that is asking an awful lot. And I don't think even if Newcastle finished fourth in the league, many of the fans would say anything nice about Mike Ashley. But Pardew, he's done a great job, hasn't he? They've sold a lot of big-name players, but he seems to have fostered a team spirit there. And in Bar, they seem to have found a player.
There you go. Team, and yet nobody likes Alan Pardew. Robin Van Persie notches his 100th goal as Arsenal defeat Bolton, who have a man sent off early in the second half. Julian, is this evidence that everything is now fine at the Emirates?
Not at all. It was one of the most pathetic first half I've ever seen at Arsenal. Great achievement for Robin Van Persie, well done to him, but that team's got no team spirit, there's no communication, they can't play together, I'm really pessimistic, unfortunately, for my lovely Arsenal team, but I can't see that team going anywhere. I'm sorry.
Your hatred of all things French is disconcerting.
Gab, one for you. Bayern Munich lost to Borussia Mönchengladbach on the first day of the season and haven't conceded since. That's 838 minutes by my calculation. And in that time frame, they've scored 28 goals, almost Barcelona rapidity. Can they keep it up?
In fact, well, no, Paddy, it is a very, very impressive clip. They've looked very good. They're not as dependent on the wingers as they were under Louis van Gaal. The certainly Ribéry's had a great start of the season. Robin's been injured, but he's come back. It's going to be a huge game, I think, against City this week. Probably the pick of the bunch. But I think the defensively, that's really amazing. It's not all down to Manuel Neuer, because you look at it in terms of the individuals at the back, they still are what they are. I don't think they're that good. Bad Stuber, Van Buyten, when Luis Gustavo plays back there. But Jerome Boateng, of course. But together, it seems to work thus far. Anyway, thanks for joining us this week. You can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, your web chats. Paddy's web chat is on Mondays. Mine's on Tuesdays. You can also follow us on Twitter. Chris, the producer, is waving at me. That can only mean one thing. We'll catch you all next week. Till then, au revoir.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.